welcome to part 3 of Midland National's quarterly audio series on characteristics of greatness. This is Jerry Blair, the Chief Distribution Officer at Midland National Life Insurance Company. It's a goal of ours to make sure that you know you aren't just a member of the Champions Club, you are part of a Midland National family that cares about you as well as your personal and professional development. To prove it to you, we've enlisted the help of 8-time New York Times best-selling author and acclaimed speaker Don Yeager. Through exclusive conversations with some of the greatest athletes and sports minds of all time, Don has identified 16 characteristics that help take a person from good to great. I'm excited to have him share with you some of these amazing stories that are sure to inspire, enrich, alter, or in some cases provide clarity in your life. As a benefit to you, please know that the lessons provided in this audio CD have enriched the quality of work in both individual and team environments. It has also unlocked the keys to success for companies worldwide. I'm confident it can have the same impact for you. Thank you again for taking the time to incorporate this into your listening library. Now I'd like to officially introduce my friend, Don Yeager. But to do so properly, I get to have a little help from the great winners like Shaquille O'Neal, Landon Donovan, Michael Orr, Tony Siragusa, Bob Costas, Dick Vitale, and the late, great John Wooden. It's quite the introduction. Let's see if you can pick out the various voices.
You're in for a real treat today.
Your speaker today, Don Yeager, is known in the sports world
as one of the most respected and nationally acclaimed writers in our country.
Don Yeager is the author of more than a dozen books,
including 8 New York Times bestsellers.
Don's books, including the one he wrote with me, have sold more than 2 million copies and have been translated into more than a dozen languages.
Don began his career at a newspaper in Texas
and rose to become associate editor of Sports Illustrated magazine, and that's how I met him.
Hey, few people can really experience the kind of exciting resume that Don has had. He's a PTP-er, baby!
In his 25 years as a journalist, Don has worked with some of the greatest champions of our time. Michael Jordan, Mia Hamm, Serena Williams, and me.
He's been a guest on just about every major national television show, from Nightline to Good Morning America to Oprah.
This is Don Yeager, who did that that article I was telling you about that's in Sports Illustrated on newsstands now. You should really get it if you're a parent who has a child who's in sports.
He lived with my father, Walter Payton, writing his autobiography while Dad courageously battled cancer.
He even met with the President of the United States in the Oval Office.
Using lessons learned from the world of sports,
Don shares the formulas he's seen and the great winners he's worked with.
And explains how that formula can work for each of us.
As I said, you're in for a real treat.
He's awesome, baby, with a capital A!
Now please welcome my friend.
My friend.
My friend.
Now please welcome my friend, Don Yeager.
Hello again, friends, and thank you for adding yet another piece of the Midland National Champions Club, What Makes the Great Ones Great audio series into your listening library. The study of high-performing individuals naturally puts the focus on winning championships, MVP trophies, or gaining legendary status. But over the course of my career studying true champions, I've gleaned that not every winner, not every great leader, winds up in the Hall of Fame. Yet they are champions in every other sense of the word. Today, we're going to talk about characteristic number 8, inner fire. Michael Jordan is considered by many people as the most famous sports-related face on the planet. He's a Hall of Famer. His 6 NBA championships with the Chicago Bulls, his heroics on the collegiate level at North Carolina, even his off-the-court endorsement deals, all are part of the Jordan brand. They are all components that make it hard to argue anyone other than MJ as being the ultimate winner. Except, of course, when he let some guy by the name of Don Yeager score on him at his own camp. One shot, one moment, Jordan was second best. Everyone knows that MJ is an all-time great, but I also will tell you that some of the greatest champions I've ever had a chance to spend time with are people who, if they walked into a crowded room without wearing a jersey or helmet, they'd probably go unrecognized. Warwick Dunn is a classic example. A few years ago, in an NFL football game, Warwick Dunn took a handoff
and dove into the line of scrimmage. And when he came out the other side, Warrick Dunn had become only the 22nd player in the history of professional football to have carried the football for 10,000 yards. Think about that. That's 5.6 miles of running, getting knocked to your knees every 9 feet, and having to get up and do it all over again. 10,000 yards. That statistic is even more amazing if you know this one. Warrick Dunn is 5'8" and weighs 178 pounds. By more than 20 pounds, he's the smallest player in the history of the sport to have carried the ball for 10,000 yards. His life story is even more amazing than that. You see, Warrick was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, born to a mother who was a police officer named Betty Smothers. Warrick was the oldest of Betty's 6 children, who she raised as a single mother. By the time Warrick was a senior in high school, he developed into a talented football player. In fact, so talented that every major college coach in America had made their way to Baton Rouge to sit on Betty Smothers' couch and ask if her son would play his college football years at their university. On Christmas Day of his senior year, with his final high school season already finished, Warrick and his mother sat down to give out gifts to his younger brothers and sisters. They opened gifts in the morning, and in the afternoon, Warrick and Betty looked at the last 3 scholarship offers he was considering for his football future. They decided that he would go to play for Coach Bobby Bowden at Florida State University. They actually called Coach Bowden that afternoon, and the Hall of Fame coach, to this day, still says that it was the greatest Christmas gift he's ever received. 2 weeks and 2 days later, the joys of that big moment were abruptly turned upside down. Warrick Dunn's cell phone rang. It was the Baton Rouge police calling to tell him that his mother, Betty Smothers, had been shot and killed in a robbery at a bank. It was 3 days past his 18th birthday, and suddenly, he was in this whole new place. He lost his mother. Even more heart-wrenching, he was now the head of a household. He had 5 younger brothers and sisters to raise. Coach Bowden actually called Warrick and said, "Young man, things are different today than they were when you made that call to us, and if you need to change directions, if you need to stay in Baton Rouge and maybe play at Louisiana State, we would understand. No hard feelings here." Warrick then said, "Coach, my mother and I made that choice together. I would never dishonor her by changing course now. I'll see you there this summer." Warrick Dunn honored his mom. He showed up at Florida State. And not only did he show up, he helped lead them to their first ever national championship. And by the time his 4-year college career was in the books, he was FSU's all-time leading rusher. 5'8", 178 pounds. The NFL draft came, and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, then coached by Tony Dungy, made the decision to use the number 12 pick overall in the first round of the draft to select Warrick Dunn. When Coach Dungy made the announcement, sports writers went into a frenzy, and several started asking questions. "Coach, what are you thinking? See, guys his size, they don't last in the NFL." One writer even said, "Coach, he's only one 350-pound lineman away from being knocked in the next year. Why would you use a pick that high on a player that small?" Tony Dungy looked at those riders and he said, "Too many of you measure athletes by their height than their weight. I measure them by the size of their heart." And he said, "By that standard, I promise you that Warrick Dunn belongs in the NFL." Not only did he belong in the NFL, Warrick actually played 13 years in the league. He carried the football, ultimately, for 11,000 yards and caught passes for 5,000 yards, and more recently became the first African-American part owner of the Atlanta Falcons football franchise. Without question, Warrick Dunn belonged in the league. But that just references the winning scene on NFL Sundays. There's another championship-worthy quality displayed by Warrick's story. It started shortly after he signed his first contract with the Buccaneers. He had more money than he ever thought he'd have. Warrick Dunn walked into Coach Dungy's office and he said, "I want to start a charity." Now, there's an awful lot of athlete charities, I know. We've all seen them. But I can honestly say, from experiencing it firsthand, that Warrick's idea is the single greatest athlete charity I've ever been around. You see, Warrick Dunn knew the value of home ownership, and he knew it was something his mother always wanted the chance to experience. So Warwick began then, as a rookie in the NFL, buying homes for women like his mother. Single mothers, working multiple jobs to put a roof over the heads of their children, Warwick wanted those mothers to experience something his mother never did, home ownership. And he will tell you that of all the things that have happened in his life, when he gets the chance to hand a set of keys to each one of those mothers and say, "Today you live my mother's dream," it's the greatest gift, not only for those families, but for himself as well. Warwick Dunn, over the course of the last 20 years, has given away 142 homes to single mothers. 385 children woke up in a house this morning that they got to call their own because of Warwick Dunn. I don't care how you want to define greatness, this guy gets it. Warwick Dunn, he gets it. Shortly before his career was over, the NFL actually recognized Warwick with the highest honor they give an athlete for his off-the-field efforts. It is called the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award. And as a result of winning that award, a big New York publisher reached out to Warwick because they read his story, and they offered him the opportunity to share his story in a book. And my good fortune is Warwick invited me to be the writer of that project. We were working on his book, and there were two storylines that just fascinated me that I knew one day would tie themselves together. The first was that if you read all the stories about the trial of the man who killed Warwick's mother, you read all those stories about the trial of that man, and it's amply noted that every time that man walked into a courtroom, Warwick Dunn got up and walked out immediately. Never once did he spend any time in the presence of the man that killed his mom. I was fascinated by that. I asked him about it, and Warwick said, "You know what? At that stage of my life, I couldn't imagine breathing the same air as someone who could do something like that." I got it. Now, the second storyline that was so fascinating to me was that Warwick Dunn was going to use this book to become the first active NFL football player to openly discuss depression. Warwick actually tells a story in the book that several years ago, one of his teammates reached out to him and said, "Young man, of all the amazing things you've done, all this unbelievable things you've accomplished, there's something about you that's not right." So if you met Warwick back then and you tried to engage him in conversation, Warwick never looked anyone in the eye. He was always looking down. The teammate who brought this to his attention encouraged Warwick to find help. Of course, seeking help for psychological issues wasn't really the cool thing to do in the NFL, especially if you're one of the smallest players in the league. But Warwick Dunn did. He found help. He found a counselor. Within an hour of meeting him, the counselor diagnosed Warwick as clinically depressed, still dealing with the fallout from the night his mother was shot and killed. The counselor put Warwick on a treatment program, and as a result of that treatment, Warwick Dunn today is an all-new man. He can share with you in all different ways, and it was a life-changing experience for him, and Warwick wanted people reading this book to understand that it didn't matter how big you were or how small you were, if you need help, you need to go get it. There were still things about Warwick's story that piqued my interest. Warwick would come to my office several times over the course of writing the book. During one of our last scheduled interviews, I said to him, "Warwick, I'm really intrigued by this. I'm wondering, you've never said a word to the man that killed your mother. Never once said a word to him. But back then you couldn't bear it, and I understand it. But now you've gone through all this treatment. Now you're in a whole different place. Warwick, if that man were to walk in and sit down with us today, what kind of things would you say to him? What kind of things would you ask?" "Whoa," Warwick said. I didn't come here today thinking that's where our interview was going to go. I'm not ready for that." And Warwick Dunn got up, and he walked out of my office. 2 days later, in perfect Warwick Dunn fashion, Warwick came bolting back through the door, and when he did, he walked over to my desk, and he handed me a notebook filled with questions. He had sat up all night asking himself what he would ask if he ever had the chance to go eye to eye with the man that killed his mother. As it happened, in the 2 days between those conversations, a friend of mine from Louisiana had called, and I'd mentioned how awkward I'd felt about Warwick leaving the office earlier that week. He said, "I remember reading a story online that said that in the state of Louisiana, if you're a victim of a crime that leads the perpetrator to death row, you can actually fill out certain paperwork. And if the inmate agrees to it, the Louisiana Department of Corrections will expedite a meeting between victim and inmate because they want the victims to find closure. Back to work, there in my office with his notebook filled with questions. He lays them out so I can see the handwriting when I ask him another question. I said, Warwick, I don't know how serious you are with this, but let me show you something. Are you aware of this law? I had printed out the article for my friend, and I said, you know, if you look at this, it says you could go ask those questions if you wanted to. Whoa, Warwick said, I don't know if I'm ready for that. I'll have to get back with you. And he turned around, and he left again. 3 days later, Warwick came back. As he walked through the doors, his first words were, let's go to Louisiana. I want to ask the questions. Now, we filled out the paperwork, and it took 6 months, which I guess in Louisiana is expedited. And at the end of those 6 months, Warwick Dunn and I and his high school football coach made our way to Angola State Prison. It's one of the toughest prisons in all of America. 91% of the inmates who enter Angola leave in a body bag. You either die on death row at the prison or your sentences are so long, you will die behind bars. We traveled through the front gates and around to the death row complex. As soon as we got out of the van, the warden came over and he embraced Warwick. He said, young man, I can't believe you're here. We haven't had a meeting like this in years. But then his words took a different turn. He said, I have to tell you though, if you came here today seeking closure, you need to know that the inmate is sitting in a cell we've got set up for you, a special cell. He's got his lawyers with him. And even though he confessed to killing your mother many years ago, he filed an appeal with the United States Supreme Court last night. And in his newest appeal, he now claims he wasn't even there the night it happened. Warwick, if you're going back there looking for closure, you need to know you're probably not going to get what you came for. I was dejected and just knew he was going to be crushed. But Warwick Dunn looked at that warden and he said, sir, I didn't come here today for him. I came here today for me. I should have known right then it was going to be one of the most amazing days I'd ever get a chance to spend. We made our way back to the cell they had set up for the meeting. In the cell there was a round table at which the inmate sat flanked by a lawyer on each side of him. Warwick Dunn sat down in the seat opposite the inmate. His high school coach sat to his right. I sat to Warwick's left. We were barely in our seats when the inmate started his whole new story about where he really was that night and why it took him so many years to remember it. And his story was going on and on and on. After about 30 minutes, Warwick Dunn finally held up his hand and he said, sir, if you weren't there that night, let me tell you what that night did to me. You see, part of that night, I used to play football with passion and emotion. I still play the game with great passion, but I have not done a single thing in my life since that night that required emotion, because everything I had drained from me. You see, part of that night, I used to dream about being a father like I never had. I used to have dreams about being a good husband like my mother never had. Sir, you should know that I've spent the last 4 years in counseling. A good portion of it, trying to learn how to hold my girlfriend's hand in public. I'm so afraid of falling in love with her because I can't lose love twice in one lifetime. As Warwick said that, a tear ran down his cheek and he started crying. And the inmate started crying. And the lawyers were crying and the coach was crying and I was crying. Just six of us sitting around a table crying. And after a few minutes of that, Warwick Dunn held up his hand again. And he said, sir, if you weren't there that night, I don't know why you came here today, but I know why I came here today. I came here to forgive somebody. We walked out of that prison. I realized I could go to the next 20 Super Bowls and maybe never see a championship moment as great as that. I've never seen one human being do something as extraordinary as that, forgiving the man who killed his mother, even after the man refused to admit the truth. We got into the van afterward and headed back to the airport. After a few minutes of a silent ride, I finally leaned forward and I said, Warwick, where did you get that? I mean, who has that in him? Warwick looked at me and he said, you know, we've talked a lot while writing this book about my mother. She was 16 when she had me. The truth is, we grew up together. And she didn't have a whole lot of formal education, but my mother had an unbelievable amount of wisdom. And that wisdom is what she used to give us as her children every day. And of all the things she used to say, the one she came back to most regularly was this. It doesn't matter if you're white or black. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're born on this side of the tracks or raised on that side. There's one thing that we all are promised. And that one thing is that there will be a day out there in which something is going to happen that will change the way you wake up the next morning. There will be a day when some kind of adversity will strike you so hard it will reshape the rest of your life. And in that moment, you will get two choices. You can be bitter, or you can be better. And as my child, I ask you to always choose better. Warwick said he was looking at that inmate, and he heard his mom's wisdom. He thought, I have a choice, and he wanted to choose better. Warwick then became for me a living, breathing example of what I will tell you is an absolute. You want to study true greatness? You want to study those who are really successful in life or sports or business? Then get this. Adversity is fuel. Adversity is an opportunity. Those moments that reshape us are moments that take us to places that we wouldn't otherwise go. They take us to do things we wouldn't otherwise do. And it's the truly great who know how to embrace those moments and use them. You know, the more I learned about Warwick and the more I studied how athletes can use adversity to tap into their inner fire, the more I realized how right Betty Smothers was. How awesome and perfect her wisdom was to her son, because adversity is so personal. It hits home for each of us. Is it about the economy? Is it about learning new and different ways to sell our products into a rapidly changing marketplace? You know, what are the things that are affecting you? Is it about your family life? Is it maybe something about your personal health? 11 years ago, a doctor walked into a hospital room and told me I had cancer. Now, we've had a great fight, and here today, I get to breathe and speak cancer-free. But what do you do when those moments hit you? How do you let them change you? For Warwick Dunn, I promise you, if his mother, Betty Smothers, was alive today, you could find her house easily in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, because he'd have her living in the biggest house there was. That's what he wanted for her. That's how much he loved her. But because she's not alive today, 385 kids woke up this morning in a house they got to call their own. That's greatness. That was characteristic number 8, inner fire. I hope that lesson unlocks greatness for you. See, the best thing about greatness is that it is available to all of us. It truly is. If you're willing to do common things uncommonly well. We look at amazing athletes and we think it's all about their physical aptitude. But greatness is truly about mental, emotional, and spiritual discipline. The great winners in this ongoing conversation have all made it quite clear they want to be part of a great team. They seek their own greatness and they also want to be part of something bigger than themselves. Thank you again for adding this to your listening library. I hope today's characteristic of greatness has been valuable to you. I also want to challenge you to go out and be great every day. By now, I hope this Midland National Champions Club audio series on what makes the great ones great is helping to tap into your inner greatness. The study of true champions has been a career drive of mine, which led me to identifying the 16 characteristics of greatness. 16 lessons that can be gleaned from the greatest athletes, winners, and team leaders of all time. Many of the greats have attained their status as a direct result of amazing accomplishment. When we see athletes like Misty May Traynor and Kerry Walsh Jennings dominate the Olympic beach volleyball world for the better part of 2 decades, there's no question they are true champions. See, seeing is believing. When we see an NFL legend like Joe Montana lead his San Francisco 49ers to 4 Super Bowls and win all 4 in convincing fashion, it's easy to come to the conclusion that he's the definition of a winner. However, in my studies of these great winners, I've learned that a consistent habit of these true winners is their ability to see themselves as successful long before the game even begins. Characteristic number 7, visualize victory. I'm going to guess that you're not surprised that I love sports movies. As a longtime sports enthusiast, I just love them. I own a bunch of them. Countless boxes of them decorate portions of my house, and I watch them all the time, from Bull Durham and Tin Cup to The Blind Side and Remember the Titans. My film room is stocked. It's because sports movies are filled with really great lessons, things that we can all learn from. And of all the sports movies that I have enjoyed over my lifetime, there's one that's my clear-cut favorite. It's called Hoosiers. The story, for those of you that don't know it, revolves around basketball at a little school in Indiana, a small school with barely enough boys for them to make a varsity team, let alone dare to win the state championship. But things come together for them, and they actually go on, and they do win that state title. In the movie, one of the most memorable scenes for me, and one that really stands out as valuable in this discussion, occurs in the semifinal game. The team is down by one, and Ollie, their worst free throw shooter, is going to the free throw line. Here's what the coach, played by Gene Hackman, said during the timeout.
Let's go, guys. All right, listen. After Ollie makes his second shot, and you will make your second shot, get back on defense right away. It may just be enough time for them to throw in a desperation toss, okay? All right. Let's go.
Put him in,
Ollie. Key! Take the good one, Strap.
That's the conversation in the timeout with just a few seconds left in the game. The game that will determine whether they get to play in the state championship or not. The coach calls the team together and says to them, remember, after Ollie makes his second shot, make sure to get back on defense. He doesn't say, hey, here's our worst free throw shooter, and if he misses these shots, make sure to foul so we get another chance to score. The coach didn't say, hey, if he hits one and he misses the other, make sure to get back. Nope. He says, after Ollie makes his second shot, make sure to get back on defense. Some of you might be wondering, what's so great about that? Well, that is a prime scenario for one of the greatest lessons and one of the most important characteristics of the truly successful. See, they visualize victory. They see themselves as successful long before they ever walk on the court. They fought through how they were going to handle success, which ultimately turned their dream into potential, and their potential into possibility, and their possibilities into reality. It reminds me greatly of a story I had the chance to write several years ago when I worked for Sports Illustrated. A story about the NBA Finals between the Miami Heat and the Dallas Mavericks. The year was 2006, and during the finals, the rules laid out the best-of-seven series in a 2-3-2 format. Essentially, the first two games would be played at one city, then the next three games at the other team's city, and then the final two games, if necessary, would be played back at the same site as the first two games in the series. This time, the Dallas Mavericks had the home court advantage, and so the first two games were played in Dallas. The Mavericks destroyed Miami. The Mavs had Dirk Nowitzki as its star player and Avery Johnson as its star head coach. They ate up Miami in the first two games to take a 2-0 lead in the series. In fact, city officials in the Dallas newspaper were quoted as saying they had already planned the Mavericks' victory parade, even with two more wins needed in order to claim the championship. Late in the third quarter of the third game, Dallas was up by 13 points, and it looked like it was over. All the prognosticators were right. Dallas was going to dominate Miami again. But suddenly, the Mavericks' lead shrunk, and the Heat came back to win the game. They won again in Game 4, and as most of the NBA world scratched their heads, confused about a series that seemed like it should have been over after just four games, now it was tied at two wins apiece. Dallas coach Avery Johnson made an announcement in a desperate attempt to shift momentum. He said, I know what's wrong with my team. I know the problem is that we're staying in a hotel in South Beach. And there are far too many distractions around us here. We need a new venue. So between games 4 and 5, he picked his team up and moved his team to a hotel in Fort Lauderdale. Because we all know there are no distractions in Fort Lauderdale. The Mavs woke up in Fort Lauderdale and came down for Game 5, and they lost again. The series stood at 2 wins for Dallas, 3 wins for Miami, and it was shifting back to Dallas for Game 6. I've been fortunate enough to know Shaquille O'Neal since he was 17 years old. My good fortune is that I've had the opportunity to be with Shaq and his family at their invitation at each one of the 4 NBA titles that he's had a chance to win. So on the morning of that Game 6, I got a call from a family member, and they invited me to Dallas to be there for that night's tip-off. It was a no-brainer for me. I accepted the invitation. I traveled to Dallas, and I arrived at the team hotel and was sitting there with Dale Brown, his college coach from LSU. We were in the lobby, and around 4 o'clock, we got a phone call from Shaquille, who told us to come up to his room at 5. So at 5 o'clock, we're up there, and we were having a great time, laughing about certain players in the league and memories from their college days. And the two of them, Shaq and Dale, were telling hilarious stories from those college days when around 5:45, Shaq got up, and he started packing his bags. Not his gym bag. He started packing his very large luggage. Shaq was loading everything into his luggage when Coach Brown looked at him and said, "Shaq, tonight's only Game 6. If you lose, you're going to have to come back to the hotel. You're going to need to play Game 7. Why are you packing your bags now? Why would you not want to leave your bags here just in case?" See, most NBA teams leave their things in the hotel and someone else loads them up after the game, if they were lucky enough to win. But that's when Shaq threw on that great grin. He probably has one of the greatest grins in all of sports. Shaq says, "Let me tell you what happened today in practice." Shaq tells a story of Pat Riley, who at that time was the head coach of the Heat. Coach Riley gathered the players at the end of practice, and they were all sure they were going to get one last nugget of wisdom, one last tip on some great way to defend Dallas for the big game. But when Pat Riley pulled his team together, he said, "I am so sure that we are going to go out and win tonight's basketball game and go home as world champions that I've already checked us out of the hotel. That's what I've done. And here's what I need you to do. At the end of today's practice, we're all going to go back to the hotel. I want each of you at 6 o'clock on the dot to come down to the lobby with your luggage. And when you come downstairs, I want each of you, not your wife, not your girlfriend, not your running mate, not your manager, I want each of you to walk to the front desk, and I want you to hand your key to the front desk clerk. I want you to say these words: thank you so much for your hospitality, but I'm not going to need my room tonight." Shaq was grinning so hard he couldn't believe it. He was so fired up he couldn't wait to get down there and watch all the other guys do it. He raced to the elevator because he wanted to be the first one in the lobby. As I sat in that lobby, I watched these amazing players, Alonzo Mourning, Dwayne Wade, James Posey, Shaquille O'Neal, one by one, walk up to this anonymous desk clerk, hand that clerk the key, while saying, "Thank you so much for your hospitality, but I'm not going to need my room tonight." And you could feel it building. I actually had this vision of that poor clerk actually at some stage ducking behind the counter to call his bookie to change his bet. He was probably like, "Scratch that." One by one, you watch these great players do this and then load themselves on the bus. They went to the Dallas Arena that night, and it didn't matter what the Mavericks did on the court. The Heat had an answer. Before it was over, the Miami Heat had won their first ever NBA title. They actually flew home that night together as a team. They laughed that they got to load their luggage on the airplane and go straight home after the victory. See, Pat Riley wanted those players to know that if you want to see yourself as successful, you have to visualize it long before the game begins. For that 2006 Miami Heat team, see, Pat Riley wanted those players to know that if you want to be successful, you have to see yourself as successful. You have to visualize it long before the game begins. For that 2006 Miami Heat team, seeing themselves winning the game had a nice championship ring to it. Characteristic number 7, visualize victory. Whether it's 7'1" and 300 pounds like Shaquille O'Neal or a small DVD of the classic movie Hoosiers, it is apparent that true greatness comes in all forms. The best thing about seeking greatness is that it is available to all of us. Greatness requires proper nutrition. What are you putting into your body? Not what do you eat or drink, but what do you consume? What are you learning? The great ones know each day is an opportunity to get another step closer to greatness. They make a conscious effort to gain something that can enhance their personal life or their professional life every day. Think about it. What are you reading? What are you listening to? Proper nutrition can fuel greatness. Thank you again for adding this to your listening library. I hope these characteristics have been of value to you. I also challenge you to go out and be great every day.
This is Jerry Blair, and I want to thank you again for making this quarterly audio series a valued part of your personal and professional development. We hope you enjoyed part 3 from Don Yeager, and we look forward to bringing you more absolutes next quarter as it relates to the 16 characteristics of greatness and the lessons learned from true champions. Until then, I hope that you are inspired to continue unlocking your own greatness and turn your future from good to great. Once again, this is Jerry Blair. On behalf of Midland National Life Insurance Company, thank you for listening.